Thank you again, everyone, for coming all the way here and for inviting me. So integrity in Chinese philosophy, the first question is, like, is there a notion of integrity in Chinese philosophy, especially in early Chinese philosophy? Well, I think there's no word in Chinese philosophy that precisely corresponds to the English word integrity. But if we're just talking about integrity in an ordinary sense, I think there are some insights in Confucian philosophy that can allow us to approximate a picture of their understanding of what a person of integrity is like. So let's just use the Oxford English Dictionary definition of integrity as a starting point of ordinary understanding of integrity. Then integrity is having strong moral principles and being morally upright, and state of being whole and undivided. So there are two connotations there. One is about having strong principles, moral principles, and the second is this kind of a state that the person is, maybe a psychological state or whatever, ethical state maybe. So if we draw on these two main connotations of the word integrity, then I think in Chinese philosophy we have some overlapping concerns regarding the importance for an ethical agent to be committed to moral principles and hold on to these moral principles, even if that means significant loss of self-interest or compromise of self-interest. There's also a huge emphasis on psychological state one should be in order to count as someone having integrity. In order to do that, I think it's going to be a very elaborate task, because we have to map out a cluster of terms related to that. And I'm just very loosely translating these terms, like loyalty, wholeheartedness, trustworthiness, a strong will, propriety. So it's going to be a difficult task, and for each of these notions, we have to do detailed textual analysis to tease out the nuances and the subtleties. So what I can do here today is just to highlight the key concepts and ideas that are relevant to our discussions of integrity. Before I do that, let me just give you a brief historical background that might be helpful to situate the readings that you have read. So in Chinese, actually, even the term Confucianism, there's no Chinese word that corresponds to that. Mm-hmm. Because Confucianism, the English word already suggests something related to Confucius. But then the Chinese term is actually Ru Jia. Lately, there's been the usage of Ruism, R-U. What R-U means is actually a group of officials at that period of time. They are mid-rank officials. They are like educators. They teach like archeries, rites, ritual practices. So these group of officials, they are Ru people. But then because of political changes, they lost their jobs. So they became kind of like private tutors. And Confucius was one of these Ru scholars. So so actually the term in Chinese, the Ru school, exists before Confucius. But then now when we talk about Confucianism as a philosophical tradition, it started with Confucius. So it's quite complicated there historically. And so, and even within the Confucian tradition, there are many phases of the development of the thought. And each phase, they tend to emphasize on different things and different aspects, even within ethics. So there's one period that emphasizes on human nature, another period on the mind. So I just focus, like, even if we just like very briefly, there are three important periods, and as you can tell, they span out over like from all the way from 500 BCE to contemporary Confucian studies. So that's about more than 2,000 years of development of thought. And the classical period is around 500 BCE to 200 BCE. And these are the philosophers probably we are most familiar with today, Confucius, Mencius, Xunzi. The second phase is less well known. It's Neo-Confucianism. And as you can tell, it kind of overlaps with the medieval period. And that's when scholars were, at that time, they were already very established, because Confucian thought is already the state ideology. You have to study Confucianism in order to become an official in the court. So they don't have any trouble like spreading the ideas and teachings of Confucius. But at that point, Buddhism started to become popular. Buddhism entered China around 1 AD, but then it took a long time, they say, to domesticate Buddhism in China. So it went through a long period of translating the text, getting people to accept Buddhist thought, and around maybe 900 AD, these Buddhist ideas started to gain popularity. So even though these Confucian scholars working at the court, they were state-sponsored scholars, they felt the need and pressure to further clarify Confucian ideas to respond to the Buddhist challenge. So this is a significant wave in the development of Confucian thought. And then the third wave is the New Confucian period. And in this period, so from the late 19th century to the late 20th century, Confucianism is no longer the state ideology, because with the establishment of Republic China, the civil exam service is abolished, so that you don't have to study Confucian text to get a job in the government. So, but then these new Confucian scholars, the sentiment to Confucianism became very mixed. Towards the early part of that period, some of these scholars, they went to the States to study. Some of them studied with John Dewey, and they got the sense that Confucianism was the reason why China was backward and undeveloped. So they want to use science and democracy, analytic philosophy, to rescue Chinese philosophy. So they still talk about Chinese philosophy, Confucianism, but using the analytic framework to do that. And sometimes they even have the slogan of smashing Confucian shop. So they think the whole Chinese society is messed up by Confucian teachings, basically. But then with the later on, the Cultural Revolution and the Maoist government, a lot of these scholars, they fled to Taiwan and Hong Kong. And then there is a renewal and revival of interest in Chinese philosophy again, because they saw what happened with Cultural Revolution. All the things that these thinkers built up, all the texts, a lot of them were burned, and you were not allowed to study. So these scholars in Taiwan and Hong Kong, they try to revive and go back to the texts and see if there's something in the Confucian early, like, traditional teaching that we can retrieve to help and to help recover the roots of Chinese culture. So these three periods, they are very different, and I hope more studies can be done in the new Confucian period. But right now, in English language studies, I would say a majority of the studies about early Confucianism, especially about early Confucian ethics. Okay. But even within that period, within the early Confucian, the classical period, the thinkers actually are very different, and they disagree about what human nature is like, whether human nature is good or bad, what human agency is about, can desire by self-motivate action, or is it also in its reasons approval? So they actually have very different view, even if they are all under the Confucian camp. But I guess there's one thing that characterizes a Confucian as a Confucian is the fact that at least they claim that they are interpreting Confucius faithfully. And that's why Xunzi, the third guy, got into a lot of trouble, because later Confucian thinkers think that what his teachings are impure because it's not a faithful interpretation of Confucius' teaching. Mencius is always hailed as the faithful interpreter of Confucius' teaching. So in order to avoid that dispute, today we're just going to talk about Confucius and Mencius. Okay. And because Confucius' teaching is so important, I'll first introduce some key notions in Confucius' teachings. But I didn't circulate any readings from the Annals because the Annals are too fragmented. It's very difficult to give you. If I have to assign, I'll assign the whole book because it's very difficult for you to see any argument. But at least in Mencius, it's still relatively fragmented by modern standards. But at least you get the conversation, the dialogue, so we can work out the argument a little bit more. So Confucius, the name is actually a Latinization of the Chinese term Kongzi. His last name is Kong, and the shis part actually means master. So Confucius, this term means Master Kong. It's not his name. And the Annals is the main source of Confucius' teaching. So this is just a book of conversations compiled actually around 60 to 70 years after Confucius' death. So yeah, this is mainly a book of conversation between Confucius and his disciples. There are three key ideals that are emphasized again and again by Confucius. And the most important one, the paramount one, probably is the first one, the Ren, R-E-N, usually translated as benevolence or compassion. Sometimes it's translated as goodness, humanity, human-heartedness. So this gives you a sense of what Ren roughly means. But the original term is very difficult to understand, even if we work in Chinese language. It's very difficult to understand. But it's quite clear that Ren is the most important ideal because the term itself appears many times in the text, and also how this term is like an umbrella term. So whenever Confucius tried to define some particular virtues, it will refer back to this big general virtue called Ren. So as you can see in the text, Ren is defined in terms of a range of particular virtues such as filial piety, wisdom, deliberation, doing one's utmost, uprightness, resoluteness, trustworthiness, respectfulness, and generosity. So somehow these particular attributes or qualities all link back to being a Ren person, a benevolent person. The second one, E, the Y-I, it's usually translated as moral propriety or moral dutifulness. Sometimes it can mean the moral sense that one has, or even like inner moral sense. In the early texts, E is often contrasted with self-interest or profit. So the idea seems to be that a moral person will always be concerned with E, so what is the morally upright thing to do, and place that before self-interest. Okay. And also this term is also related to shame, so that you cannot accept yourself fall below a certain standard, so to speak. And the third key term there is Li, L-I, which is usually translated as ritual or rites. What is interesting with this term, like what Confucius has done with it, is that Confucius has broadened the meaning of term. Again, this term itself existed before Confucius, but it mainly refers to just ceremonial practices, religious ceremonies, the kind of rituals that people usually do in ceremonies. But what Confucius has done is that he broadened this term so that it has to include the underlying quality or emotion or attitudes that need to be present in order for you to conduct these ceremonies. So it's not just the outward performance itself that count as li, ritual. You also have to have the right attitude or spirit in the performance. So it's this inner-outer interdependence that's being introduced by Confucius. I should also note that in the early texts, you might find numerous references to kings, sages, superior person or gentleman. All these are terms, general terms used to mean the idealized ethical person. So these sage kings, they are legendary kings, like maybe according to the legend around 2000 BCE. Whether they exist or not, it doesn't seem to concern the Chinese readers that much. It seems it's just accepted that these are the moral exemplars, and there is a hope that everyone can attain that stage if we ethically cultivate ourselves. And their deeds and what they have said became an important part of Chinese history as well. So, and also, but then it's acknowledged even by Confucius, mentions that this kind of sagehood is extremely difficult to attain. So there's also this emphasis on the superior person or the morally superior person. So it's good enough maybe that you work your way to a morally superior person, so that at least you are contrasted with the morally petty kind of person. So the Chinese term for that is actually junzi, J-U-N-Z-I. What this is significant is that before Confucius, junzi, this superior person, refers to someone who's noble by right of birth. Okay, but Confucius again transformed the meaning so that it doesn't denote a noble rank anymore, but it means someone who live up to ethical ideals, who live up to ethical standards. So this term no longer means social class or superior social class, but it means someone who has the ethical quality. And often contrasted with the petty kind of person who is full of anxiety. So the morally petty person is characterized as someone who's full of anxiety, who just cares about profit, self-interest, who try to be similar to others, get others to like them, but they are not really harmonious. By contrast, the ethically superior person, they are easy of mind, they understand moral rightness, they do not seek to be similar to others, but they care about harmony. Okay, so this is the basic background of Confucius ideals. And when it gets to Mencius, these ideas about a superior person and the importance of upholding moral standards got developed further. So Mencius' dates were roughly 385 to 312 BCE, and he's actually two generations after Confucius, and he's hailed as second sage. As I said, he traveled to many states to give political advice, and so a lot of these dialogues, it's, as you will find, they are between Mencius and the rulers, or Mencius and his disciples. And Mencius is most famous for his theory of human nature, and his writing, well, not his writings, but the text is more elaborate, and you get better sense of the ideal ethical person, and that ideal is often characterized as someone who will hold on to his ethical commitments. You will also find in the text that most of the time it's analogical reasoning, so there's extensive use of analogies to make the point, rather than deductive reasoning. Okay. What I will do now is I'll present you his negative view, more like a negative angle for us to look at his view on integrity, and then a positive angle. So the negative angle is that we can get a glimpse of what the kind of person he idealized by looking at what he criticized, this group of people that in our language may be something like spineless people. And at Confucius' time, there was this group of officials in village. They tend to hold a certain rank, and these are not very important political positions, but in the village it means something, and they're called village worthies, the title. And Confucius, in the Annalettes, there's just a very brief remark condemning these village worthies as thieves of virtue. That's all we've got. It didn't get elaborated on. And then in Mencius, that idea got developed, and there is a dialogue between a disciple and Mencius. So disciple asked Mencius, why would Confucius call these people thieves of virtue? Because they are very nice, they are good men, they're very careful in their conduct. Why would Confucius call them thieves of virtue? And Mencius' reply is interesting. This is actually in one of the passages I gave, 7b37. Mencius replied that if you would blame them, you find nothing to allege. If you would criticize them, you have nothing to criticize. They agree with the current customs, they consent with an impure age. Their principles appear to be right-heartedness and truth, their conduct appear to be disinterestedness and purity. All men are pleased with them, and they deem themselves so, so that one cannot proceed with them to the principles of the sage king. So, and then later on, Mencius goes on to express his frustration with the village worthies trying cringingly to please the world. So there's something about the village worthy that's really bothering Mencius, and it has to do with the fact that they try so hard to please others, get others to like them, but you cannot find anything wrong with what they say or what they do. I take it that the general point Mencius is making here is that the village worthy is preoccupied with others' opinion of them. In order to seek the approval of others, they would take on whatever role that they think will please their audience, adjusting their words and actions to conform to their expectations. For whatever qualities that they have exhibited to their audience, they would change these qualities in response to the changing expectations of others. I think the only way, or maybe like one highly plausible explanation for such quick changes of mind and action, is that these village worthies do not have a mind of their own. That is to say, they do not really have the relevant mental states they ascribe to themselves. So metaphorically speaking, this village worthy is like chameleon without any true color of his own. Now, if we follow something like Gabriel Taylor's definition of integrity, we would say that a person of integrity is someone who preserves her identity, who is capable of evaluating different course of action, who does not repeatedly act against her evaluation, and whose identity is not threatened by mutually undermined identifications. So if we are working with this kind of account of integrity, then the village worthies lack integrity, not because there is a break between motive and action though, but because he does not have anything that can be considered as truly his own. Although he professes his beliefs and values, he does not identify with any of them. Since he does not have any identification of his own, he's not even in a position to have mutually undermining identifications. It is not that his integrity is corrupted. It's more like he's not even in a condition to possess integrity to begin with. And more problematically, what drives this whole quest for public approval is not even a commitment to building a moral character. So this is different from the kind of hypocrite that I guess we usually find in literature or in politics, well, maybe not politics, in literature, who wants to be moral, or who are committed to morality, but have somehow got the nature of morality wrong or failed to follow through in actions. The village worthy is not even committed to self-improvement and ethical standards. The object of his attention is devoid of ethical concern and is focused solely on self-interest. Okay, so this is the negative picture, I take it. So if this is something that's so frustrating to Mencius, then we can at least infer that having integrity must be very important in Mencius' view. Now, let us try to move on to the positive picture. So for Mencius, there are four ideals, four ethical ideals. It's same as Confucius with the three, like Ren, Yi, Li, and he also adds a fourth, the wisdom. Sometimes it's related to practical deliberation as well, some scholars think. What is interesting is that for Mencius, he thinks that we are all born with sprouts or innate beginnings in our heart or mind that can grow into these ideals. So the beginnings are already in us, in our human nature already. All we have to do is to grow them or develop them into these ideals. So it's interesting to note that for Mencius, the sprout of benevolence is sympathy or compassion. The sprout of propriety is shame and disgust. The sprout of ritual is courtesy and modesty. And the sprout of wisdom is a sense of right and wrong. So I think of particular interest to us today is this ideal of Yi, the moral dutifulness, and how we have this innate sense of shame and disgust that can be developed into Yi. And a very famous passage that discusses how one should not give up Yi, even if this is a matter of life and death, is found in Mencius 6:8-10. So I think in your reading, that's page 128. This is a very famous passage that's quoted again and again. So fish is what I want, bear's palm is also what I want. If I cannot have both, I would rather take bear's palm than fish. Life is what I want, moral dutifulness is also what I want. If I cannot have both, I would rather choose moral dutifulness rather than life. So just a little bit of context, like bear palm is considered really precious and fish is just too common. And then Mencius goes on to say, here is a basketful of rice and a bowlful of soup. Getting them would mean life, not getting them would mean death. When these are given with abuse, even a wayfarer would not accept them. When these are given after being trampled upon, even a beggar would not accept them. Yet, when it comes to 10,000 bushels of grain, one is supposed to accept without asking if it is in accordance with the rights or if it is right to do. What benefit are 10,000 bushels of grains to me? Do I accept them for the sake of beautiful houses, the enjoyment of wives and concubines, or for the sake of gratitude my needy acquaintances will show me? And it goes on, so this way of thinking is known as losing one's original heart. So the idea is that in a very simple situation, if you really need a bowl of rice, but someone insult you with a bowl of rice, you won't take it. Or so basically, this is related to that sense of shame and disgust. We cannot take that kind of insult. But then the point is, but when someone is being offered maybe a very important political position or high remuneration salary, then one doesn't ask if this is in accordance with moral propriety. One just take that for self-interest, for feeding family, the wives, the concubines, for showing off to the colleagues. So this is the main idea. So losing the original heart, that in a simple situation you know what you would do, but then in the latter situation you don't question. And then there's another passage I should highlight, which is 3B2. So Mencher says, when the ethical person has achievement, he shares these with the people. When he fails to do so, he practices the moral way alone. He cannot be led to excesses when wealthy and honored, or deflected from his purpose when poor and obscure, nor can he be made to bow before superior force. This is what I would call a great man. So again, the idea is that the ethical person might or might not find herself in a situation where moral standards are upheld or recognized, but it won't affect the ethical person herself, because she will hold on and uphold these moral standards regardless whether it's in a corrupt environment or a morally upright environment. So we can talk about these passages later, and I just close by talking about some recent trends in research. As you can see probably already, that for the early Confucians, what matters is not just what you do, but also the kind of psychological state that you are in. And that is probably why it prompts recent research into moral psychology, Confucian moral psychology. And there is also a growing interest in comparative studies. So I guess the point of the way of articulating Confucian thought in an analytic way is to make the insights more intelligible to contemporary audience. And also, this will also help us make better sense of the text itself. And that's in the two secondary readings I assigned for the group. The two papers, the drafts by Quang Loi-Shun, I think he is one representative in this kind of work, who works on moral psychology and who use a rather analytic way of articulating the ideas and make it familiar to contemporary audience. And for example, if you have a chance to read that paper on reflective equanimity, the idea of that paper is that an ethical agent who is committed to upholding ethical standards can still have feelings and be engaged with others, but there is also this posture of calmness and steadfastness that cannot be undermined. And that has to do with how the ethical agent's commitment has reshaped her character, so that following ethical path is of greatest significance to her. And given her ethical character, there is something that she cannot allow herself to do. And this, I think, relates back to Mencher's point that moral dutifulness is a development of our incipient feelings of shame. And I'll just say, so what can we take from this? For example, I think one appealing insight we can get from this paper is that the distinction we may draw between the form of rationality in which a rational agent deliberates and the kind of person a rational agent is like. So what matters to early Confucians, it seems, is not the way in which an agent may fail in practical deliberation to correctly identify the course of action she ought to take, but the various ways in which the agent may regard a certain course of action, say X, as the only mean, as the only means for her, even when alternatives like Y and Z are present. This may happen when X is of the greatest significance to her, that Y and Z are no longer alternatives to her anymore. It is also possible that Y and Z, being the only alternative to X, are things that the agent herself cannot conceive of herself doing. So for the agent, X then becomes the only means and is therefore something she ought to do. Y and Z are the things that the agent finds herself incapable of doing, at least not doing so intentionally. This picture suggests that the agent is holding herself to certain standards, that she refrains from Y and Z not because she thinks it undesirable to violate some externally imposed standards, agent center restriction that apply to her, but because it is some internal restriction that she imposed on herself that she cannot bring herself to do Y and Z. So this is just an example of how like recent research on Confucian moral psychology can contribute to our discussion of, say, the debate between Williams and the consequentialists about how consequentialists fail to take into account the importance of integrity. So this is basically the end of my introduction.